Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And former Utah Governor John Huntsman made it official today, dropping out of the race for the Republican presidential nomination.
Today, I am suspending my campaign for the presidency. I believe it is now time for our party to unite around the candidate best equipped to defeat Barack Obama. Despite our differences and the space between us on some of the issues, I believe that candidate is Governor Mitt Romney.
Mitt Romney is now leading by about 7 points in South Carolina over Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum, who battle it out for second. Thomas Burr covers politics for the Salt Lake Tribune. Some analysts saying Huntsman leaving because polls show him losing to comedian Stephen Colbert. But were you surprised Romney was not standing there to get the endorsement? The two have a lot of common, but Huntsman mentioned differences. And we're hearing there's not a lot of love lost between these two men.
That's true. And as I understand it, Governor Huntsman actually asked that Governor Romney not be there. The two have had an interesting past. It goes back to 2002 when John Huntsman wanted to, his father won, and he both wanted him to run the Salt Lake 2002 Olympics. Of course, Mitt Romney ended up getting the job, so there was a little bit of a fight back then. You know, they're actually distant cousins in some ways, but they haven't exactly been the best friends over the years. So this may be in part to John Huntsman said, look, I'm dropping out. I want the states to myself.
Well, and, you know, both Mormons, but we are hearing, you know, anecdotal stories from Utah. One woman saying, and again, this is just a story told, that she was asked to leave her job because she didn't support Mitt Romney. She supported John Huntsman. What are the other thoughts out of the state? Because, again, a fiscal conservative, may be seen as liberal on some social issues like gay marriage, but he was enormously popular at one time.
He was. In fact, he was elected. John Huntsman was elected with 78% of the vote. 78, not that, if you can believe that, it was like a 56-point margin over his Democratic opponent in 2008. Since then, though, there's been quite a bit of a change, and part of it could be that Huntsman left to go work for President Obama as the U.S. ambassador to China. Part of it could be that somehow, you know, Huntsman is seen as distancing himself from his Mormon faith. You know, he talked a little more about being culturally Mormon and not necessarily, you know, going to church every Sunday. That doesn't really go over too well in Utah, and neither do, you know, taking positions on civil unions, which Huntsman backs, or, you know, things like climate change. Those are not popular positions in Utah. There's been some speculation that now that Huntsman's out, maybe he'd come back and he'd run against Senator Orrin Hatch. That's probably not going to happen, because if Huntsman were to run for election again in Utah, it's not very clear he could get past the delegate.
So from your learned perch, do you think that John Huntsman's backers will go to Mitt Romney? Mitt Romney has about a 6-7 point lead. You know, the 5% or so of Huntsman backers might put him on the top.
Well, that's certainly what John Huntsman wants to have happen. You know, his announcement, you know, the clip you just played, he's trying to get his people to go that way. It's not a big amount of people we're talking about. 5% is still within a pretty close part of the margin of error. So we're not talking about a big thing that everyone's going to be fighting for. You know, certainly some of them will split off. Maybe some go to Santorum, some go to Gingrich. But, you know, these are people who might be, you know, more independent, more moderate, who can see Mitt Romney as an easy alternative choice.
Yeah. You mentioned Rick Santorum. We know over the weekend that influential group of national Christian conservatives picked Rick Santorum as their candidate, and he tried to use John Huntsman's exit today as an attack on Mitt Romney, because he said, well, Governor Huntsman ran as a moderate trying to compete with Governor Romney for the establishment moderate vote, but Governor Romney already had that sewed up, and Governor Huntsman wasn't able to crack through. Rick Santorum trying to, again, you know, attack this idea that Romney is a conservative, portraying him as a moderate.
Yeah, and, you know, that's a good question coming out, because John Huntsman wasn't necessarily getting that conservative part of the vote. He largely wasn't getting the evangelical vote, which Mitt Romney certainly could use in South Carolina. So the idea of them coming together, and it's an easy hit for Santorum to say, look at these two guys together. They're the most moderate people in the race, and then there's me. I'm the complete alternative to that. You know, the Christian Coalition coming behind Rick Santorum is certainly going to give him a little bit of a boost in South Carolina. But you also have voters out there saying, well, look, it looks like Romney's the guy. I'm not sure that voting for Rick Santorum is much of a good use of my vote.
Yeah. Thomas Burr covers politics for the Salt Lake Tribune. Thomas, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
on this Martin Luther King Day, a story now that starts after King's assassination on April 4th, 1968. In the racially charged days after Reverend King was killed, a young white priest, the Reverend John Brooks, drove the country looking for young black high school students to recruit for the almost totally white Jesuit school where he taught, the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts. Among the young men who came, a future U.S. Supreme Court Justice, Clarence Thomas, a future Pulitzer Prize-winning author, Edward Jones, one, Eddie Jenkins, became a Super Bowl champion. Another, Ted Wells, represented Scooter Libby when he was charged in the Valerie Plame case. Diane Brady tells their stories in her fascinating new book, Fraternity. She's a reporter for the Bloomberg Businessweek and joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Diane, welcome.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
And we're also joined by someone, I think, sitting right there with you, one of the former Holy Cross students, Stan Grayson. He would become New York City Finance Commissioner and Deputy Mayor for Finance and Economic Development in the 80s. Stan, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And Stan, if you would just talk about that time first, 1968. You had already been recruited to Holy Cross to play basketball. But you pole vault into this time that started with the assassination of Martin Luther King and went through the Vietnam protests and upheaval, not to mention what you were confronting, which was race.
People were confused, troubled, angry. When I got to Holy Cross, I think it was really also trying to find its way. You know, I think the one thing that time did, it brought a bunch of black students together who were from, by and large, urban America, who had kind of had similar experiences, struggling to kind of make sense of what was going on socially, politically, and the like. And I think in that core group, there was a lot of comfort because we were together and were able to kind of commiserate, discuss, share visions, conclusions. So it was a strange time, but you know, you sort of had a lot of help getting through those strange times.
Especially since you landed in Worcester, Massachusetts. Now, it's got beautiful campuses. It's in an area where there's a lot of fading mill towns. And at that time, not a lot of black faces.
Not a lot of minority faces, period.
Yeah. So, Diane, about how many black students are we talking about coming with Stan to Holy Cross in 1968?
Well, there were a total of 20, including Clarence Thomas, who transferred as a sophomore. And then prior to that, there had been essentially one or two a year. I think one came on an athletic scholarship. One would come through the academic route. And essentially, I think you would have been looking at 28.
So, Stan, take us through this. You arrived. Now, you had gone to a largely white school in Detroit where, you know, you just won the state championship, I think, with your high school team. So it could be said that you were maybe more comfortable than some of your friends around white students, but just what was the feel like when you first got to campus?
Well, when I first got to campus, you know, I think a natural reaction is who that looks like me is also here. Back then, we ate family style, which is very interesting, that we would all go to the dining hall and sit down and be served and eat together, which I think created an opportunity after we met a few of us black students to kind of say, what time are you going to dinner, and sit down and have that hour, hour and a half together once or twice a day to sit and chat.
Well, you know, it's interesting because as you start to see, as Diane's story unfolds, what starts to happen is that many of the black students self-segregate. They want to sit together to eat. They form a black student union. Some of them want to live together on a corridor. It would be called the Black Corridor. And this became very controversial. And wait a second, the whole idea was to create this diversity. And now, you know, there's a movement to sort of segregate.
You're absolutely right. But I would say you have to go back to the times.
Right.
And the one thing that I will say that I think allowed me to successfully navigate Holy Cross was having the Black Corridor. My sophomore year, Father Brooks agreed that we could live together, even though we called it a black corridor. But my roommate and half of the folks on the floor were, in fact, white.
Right.
But it still created a focal point on campus where it was like a safe haven for us all.
So, Diane, I think it's time that, you know, that we've set a little of this scene, that we talk a little bit about Father Brooks, who's still alive today, but who is the man who was on this mission to recruit black students, inspired, you know, by the life of Martin Luther King and then determined to do something in response to his death. Who was this man?
He's a very strong personality, and it was striking that a lot of the people I talked to who knew him, that was very clear that what John Brooks wanted, John Brooks pretty much went and got, and I should say Father Brooks, but he is very much, a dominant personality and took it upon himself to not only say, okay, if we're going to do this, let's get it done, but where's the money? And at this juncture, to sit down in a restaurant and in some cases personally choose men and simply work around the process, the admissions process. It was Father Brooks that picked them. It was not the usual admissions committee.
The thing that I most appreciated about him was not just his interest in me as an athlete, but he was always concerned about you, the person. You know, I can't tell you the times he would say, I know all that, I read all that, but what do you think? And so he was the kind of guy who taught many of us how to think, I think, by asking probing questions and constantly reminding us when we needed to be reminded why we were in college, and that was to get an education.
And I think that's important because, you know, one thing, there was a big divide. People talk about affirmative action, but there was never any sense that the academic standards would be bent. There was no special concessions, correct me if I'm wrong, Stan.
No,
it was you did the essays, you got the marks, you either got it or you didn't. Where there were concessions was on the social front.
But, you know, Father Brooks didn't always agree with that. He agonized over the Black Corridor, although he went along with it. And there was another time, Stan Grayson, when some of the students pushed to get the lyrics to the school song changed.
That was you, Stan.
Yes,
that was, yeah. You apparently winced every time you heard it. Do you even remember it now?
Oh, I do. Old Mamie Riley. Where'd you get that hat? Down in Old Kentucky from Old Black Joe were the words to the song.
Well, and Brooks had sung it lustily. You know, people loved the song. What did it mean to you?
It showed a lack of sensitivity is what it meant to me. And I think to the extent that you've got a growing Black population on campus, it just seemed inappropriate.
There was some debate. He insisted that this was a tradition. But to you, again, it was what, a throwback to slavery, Jim Crow?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And
to his credit, he, notwithstanding his initial reaction, he listened to the arguments and concluded, tradition or not, that Holy Cross is bigger than that. I think that's one of the things that many of my colleagues think is special about Holy Cross. They're able to recognize right from wrong and acknowledge, frankly, when things aren't exactly right or what they could be or should be.
Stan Grayson, one of several young African Americans recruited by Holy Cross priest John Brooks after the assassination of Martin Luther King. Their story is told in Diane Brady's new book, Fraternity. In 1968, Newsweek estimated there were more than 6 million undergrads in U.S. colleges, but only 275,000 were Black, about 4%, and only a handful at Holy Cross. Some of the other things they faced, they had to organize field trips to Boston just to meet girls. But then Black students at Holy Cross confronted institutional racism. We're going to hear more about that in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Diane Brady, the author of the new book Fraternity, which tells the story of the Holy Cross professor, Father John Brooks, who was motivated by the death of Martin Luther King to travel cross-country recruiting African-American students to come to the largely white school. Students like future Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, future lawyer Ted Wells, and Stan Grayson, who'd go on to become a high-ranking New York official and who joins us now. And Stan, take us back to 1969. Now, Black and white students tried to block the big defense contractor, GE, from recruiting at Holy Cross. Students were identified from protest photos. They were suspended. But the Black students said Blacks were identified disproportionately because there were so few on campus. They were easier to identify than the whites. So Blacks called for a walkout.
This is my sophomore year when this happened, and early on in the basketball season, and I was in New York playing my first varsity game. When I got back to campus, the lights were all on the campus, and Ted Wells met me at the bus and explained to me what happened. And, I think like most of the students, thought about it, spoke to my mom and dad, told them what had happened, told them what my view was, that I thought if the black students were going to leave, that I was also going to leave.
And we should say they decided to have a walkout in protest.
That's exactly right.
And the walkout is quitting school. It wasn't simply just...
Right.
Well, Stan, you could have, all of you, as I was reading this, I was thinking, you're about to throw away these college educations.
I will tell you, there were a number of my hallmates, roommates, who came to me and said, listen, you're playing basketball, the season's just started. If you want to stay, we understand, you know. So I think when I decided to leave, many of my colleagues said, if Stan's going and risking what we think is a very bright future for him, then we're going as well.
Well, you held a dramatic press conference, threw down your IDs, walked out, Father Brooks passing some money to you as you left. The student body threatened a boycott in support of the black students. The local papers editorialized against you. Father Brooks arranged a debate. It became heated, but it convinced the then president, the Reverend Raymond Swords, to lift all the suspensions. Very powerful story. But Stan, fast forward to 1972. Father Brooks is now Holy Cross president himself. And you and the black students take over a building protesting for more black faculty and courses. Father, President Brooks, asks you to leave, saying he'll personally look into the charges. Now, everyone did leave. Do you think this was only possible because of the trust that had been built up between the students and Father Brooks?
I think absolutely. I think there was always a sense that Father Brooks was a man of his word. You know, I think at that time, leading up to this building takeover, there was just growing frustration that, you know, there were a lot of things that black students felt the college could and should do to make it a better place.
Stan, I have to ask you,
sure.
We haven't yet mentioned one of the other students you were with, Clarence Thomas,
mm-hmm.
who, you know, many people now know Clarence Thomas for his strong stand against affirmative action. And, you know, it, as we obviously note, you know, he benefited from it. He was one of your fellow recruits. Have you had conversations with him about that? What's your sense of that?
We've talked over the years, and you know, basically, we agree to disagree in large part on the relevance and importance of affirmative action. You know, I contend that Clarence bases his premise on the fact that the world is perfectly round. In my view, the world's not perfectly round, so you can't start with that premise, and therefore, there are needs to kind of equalize or stabilize things, and affirmative action is one of those tools that was created to do that.
You know, one thing that's interesting, when I spoke to Justice Thomas about his experience at Yale versus his experience at Holy Cross, at Holy Cross he never felt that people questioned his intelligence, that they questioned his right to be there, and that he clearly would have gotten in on his own merits. He was a member of the equivalent of the Honors Society. And when he got to Yale, he felt that it was very much a case where he was diminished in the eyes of his fellow students. And then when you fast forward to what he thinks happened in the years after, he talks about the sheer volume of people trying to get minority students on campus, that he felt students that were being brought into places where they couldn't cut it, where they perhaps would not have gotten in otherwise on their own merits. Now, that's debatable, but that's the view that he has today in terms of why he thinks affirmative action overall has been demeaning to minorities and has not worked.
And just to quickly note, Clarence Thomas, as a student, showed some of these signs of, you know, maybe perhaps a contrarian view. You know, when you were in school, he was sort of the debater, the person who wanted to, you know, be on the other side of something just to see what would happen.
No question. He liked the lively conversation. He liked the lively discussion, and often would go out of his way to sort of engage others in a discussion by taking a what I would call a contrary position on a given subject.
And then there was Ted Wells, became a lawyer, as we said, represented Scooter Libby, you know, kind of a famous client. You, as we said, worked for the City of New York and also one of the country's oldest minority-owned investment banks. Edward Jones wrote the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Known World. Some have died, but those who are living, have you stayed in touch?
I'm in touch with all of those. With, you know, 4 years in college together, and particularly at Holy Cross, I think has created a bond that, you know, even my kids marvel at the relationship and the bond that I have and or we all have with each other.
I think that these men were a support network for each other, and I really do think they changed the college as much as the college changed them.
Yeah. That's Diane Brady. Her book is Fraternity. It tells the story of the handful of black students recruited by the largely white Holy Cross College in 1968. One of them, Stan Grayson, also joined us. Stan, Diane, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And take just a second to look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, critics say recent FDA rules about antibiotics and farm foods are useless, but is there a bigger plan afoot? That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, why are the super rich still investing in real estate? Wasn't that the bubble that blew? Latest news is next, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, and by the Harvard Art Museums, from Chinese jades to Jasper Johns, Byzantium to Bernini. Learn more at harvardartmuseums.org. And by the Institute of Contemporary Art Boston, with Isaac Julian's 10,000 Waves, a 9-screen video installation featuring Maggie Chung, icaboston.org.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. If all goes as planned, ice-locked Nome, Alaska should start getting fuel from that Russian tanker Renda within the next day or so. Crews are building a path over a half mile of Bering Sea ice to lay a hose to pump diesel gas and home heating oil from the tanker to shore. A November storm prevented Nome's 3,500 residents from getting a fuel shipment earlier, and supplies will run out in the spring without the Russian reinforcement. Meanwhile, over in Valdez, officials are offering workers $20.30 an hour to help the 170 people already recruited to dig that town out from more than 322 inches of snow. That's about 27 feet. Journalist Geo Beach joins us from Homer, Alaska. Geo, is the thinking that that extra 30 cents, you know, in addition to the $20, might get these workers into Valdez?
There's a lot of snow and not quite enough elbow grease, Robin. It just stacks up in Valdez. They're well on their way to a record year, and the piles in town are reaching 30 feet and too much on the roof, so it's got to get off of there. But, you know, there's so much opportunity private sector that twice in a week the city has tried to boost the wage to get enough people to get the snow cleared. Right next door over in Cordova, they have enough people to shovel their record-setting snowfall, which is on a par with Valdez. They've just burned through the supply of shovels. You know, it's Alaska. It's tough snow. You can't have a plastic consumer-grade shovel to get it out of there. And there's been a special shipment direct from the manufacturing plant in the lower 48 to try and get the proper armaments into the hands of Cordovans.
And to the Russian tanker, which began its journey in mid-December to pick up diesel fuel in South Korea before heading to Alaska. The ship owner says even with the help of the Coast Guard cutter Healy, making it through this Bering Sea ice was a big challenge. Tell us more about this, because I believe you had a friend who was a Marine pilot in this action.
My good friend Peter Garay is really the dean of SWAPA, the Southwest Alaska Pilots Association. He volunteered for this mission because it's so dicey. It's never been done before in an icebound United States port. Really, there's only one available icebreaker. That's Healy, which had just finished a mission in the north and was held over an additional month or more to be able to plow a path. And it was going to be a Canadian icebreaker, but the United States Coast Guard decided that would be giving too much away to international interests. Truly, things are changing here in the Arctic, and notwithstanding our extremely cold winter, climate change means that in coming years, the much sought-after and mystical Northwest Passage is going to open up, and America at this point in time is ill-prepared to address that for environmental issues, for minerals exploration, and for military over-the-top issues.
So there's a lot more going on here than, you know, the headlines, people stuck and without diesel and such. And we understand where you are. They're on the Kenai Peninsula. An avalanche has closed the only road and railroad from Anchorage to the peninsula?
Yeah, we're back up now, but it's a very thin line that connects us here at the terminus of the North American highway system to the rest of civilization. And I'm in Homer, what we call the banana belt, the Alaska Riviera. Right now, we're about 0 degrees in Homer, so we're sort of on the straddling the lines between the haves and the have-nots. The have-nots would include Nome, that got down to 40 below starting in November, and currently Fairbanks, where it's pushing 50 below. When they say it's cold in Fairbanks, they're not kidding. And for mathematicians out there who like to figure their Celsius Fahrenheit equivalents, it's easy at 40 below, because 40 below is the same in Celsius and in Fahrenheit. It's C-O-L-D.
Well, and just you mentioned climate change. I just want to say that although you're not a meteorologist, you do say that this weather that they're seeing, a huge snowdrop, is the Pineapple Express. That's this high-pressure front from Hawaii that meets a cold front from Siberia. It's a weather cycle?
That's exactly correct. Sometimes that's a warmer phenomenon we call a Chinook, which melts things in the wintertime. But no such luck here. The Siberian air mass raining over Alaska is just way too cold for that.
Geo Beach, journalist and writer in Homer, Alaska, giving us the latest from that state, which has several big news stories going on. Geo, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And coming up, speaking of the haves and the have-nots, the problem of the very rich and where to put their cash. This is not about envy. It's about real estate. In 30 seconds, here and now. Last week, we heard the study showing Americans increasingly concerned about the growing inequality between the very rich and your average bear. But the very rich have problems of their own, including where to safely put their money, and many have been choosing to invest in prime real estate. A recent story in the online journal Russia Today reported that a Russian billionaire spent $88 million for a four-bedroom apartment on Central Park West in New York. His young daughter moved in. In Miami Beach, the owner of the Russian Standard Bank and Russian Standard Vodka paid $25 million for an estate, the most expensive home purchase in that city since 2006. The same thing's happening in London, where property prices are soaring, and as the BBC's Michael Robinson reports, that's proving to be a problem for other Londoners.
These birds are lucky. They live for free, a stale breadcrumb's throw from Kensington Palace in the heart of London. While house prices in much of Britain have been stagnant or falling, in this super-exclusive neighbourhood, they rose 12% last year, and business is brisk.
This particular list I have here in front of me is 5 million plus viewings.
£5 million plus, so what, $7.5 million?
$7.5 million precisely, and upwards.
Mark Redfern runs the Kensington office of the upmarket estate agents Knight Frank.
I would say that we've got here a good 20 or 30 new individuals who have come into the market in the last week who are looking in that kind of price range.
I've just seen £22 million.
Though. Somebody just viewed a house of ours at £22.5 million. I was out with a gentleman last week who has a budget up to £40
million. £40 million for a residential home?
For a residential home.
According to Yolanda Barnes, a housing analyst of another top-of-the-market London estate agency, Savills, it's not just the British super-rich who are buying.
At the very top end, what we call ultra-prime, which is over £5 million, three-quarters are from overseas.
Three-quarters?
Yes, three-quarters of ultra-prime buyers.
Why is that?
There are several reasons. The worse the world gets, the more economic and political turmoil, it seems, the better London gets. And London properties are being used as a store of wealth, so it has quite close correlations, for example, with the market for gold. So when people are buying gold, they also tend to be buying prime central London properties.
Price rises in ultra-prime areas caused by super-rich buyers have rippled out across London.
This is the quiet street in West London where I live. It's two-storey terrace houses, very simple, and estate agents around here tell me that since 1997, the price of these houses has gone up by around £350,000.
While I was recording, the man who sweeps our street came by.
My name's Mark Milcury, and
hello,
I'm from
Mark.
Roehampton.
I'm making a radio programme.
OK.
And I've just worked out that every year these houses have gone up by about £25,000 a year since 1997.
Wow. Yeah.
Every year since 1997.
Yeah, that's a lot.
It is a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, how does that compare with what you're earning?
I get about 13,000, something silly.
About 13,000. That's half the average wage.
Yeah. Yeah.
So these houses have gone up by double what you earn.
Yeah, and our wage doesn't seem to ever go up.
Every year?
No, yeah. I'm on the same wage that I was when I started here 12 years ago. It's everything else goes up by the day. Like to get on buses and shops, and I don't know what really to do.
Is it enough to live on, half average
not really,
wage?
No.
For someone like Mark Melchiori, on half British average wages, home ownership is effectively impossible. But what about people who earn the average wage of £26,000 or more? At a school in northwest London, far from the select superprime parts of the city, teacher Rebecca Percy is going home to Australia because she's found it impossible to buy.
The area where I live in, I travel about half an hour. For a two-bedroom flat, that isn't particularly memorable. It could be up to £500,000.
Half a million?
Yes.
To buy such a flat, Rebecca Percy says, she'd need a 20% upfront cash deposit and need to be earning around £100,000 a year. Do you have that?
No. And none of my friends, who are all professionals, have managed that. I'm a senior teacher, so I earn £45,000.
£45,000 is well above average wages.
It is.
And despite that, there's still no way you say you could buy a property.
Perhaps I could in 10 years' time. So I've decided to go back to Australia, where they're not giving away properties in Australia either, but it is something that's still relatively achievable for a professional to do.
With wages stagnating and London house prices still rising, that's a problem that's likely to get worse. British political leaders now all say they're concerned about growing inequality, but they're yet to come up with a strategy to reverse a trend of more than 30 years.
That report from Michael Robinson of the BBC. Well, today we're hearing about the influence of Martin Luther King. But did you know it stretches from the streets of Montgomery, Alabama, to Cairo, Egypt, through a comic book? At the height of the protest in Tahrir Square last year, 29-year-old human rights activist Dalia Ziada handed out an Arabic version of the 1950s comic book Martin Luther King and the Montgomery Story. It told the story of the famed bus boycott. Dalia had never even heard of Martin Luther King until she attended a civil rights conference in 2006. After that, she told us, she modeled everything she did after the African-American civil rights pioneer.
The most inspiring thing about Martin Luther King for me was that he was a young man when he started a movement that changed the history of the U.S. and probably the whole world. He believed very much in civil rights and in reaching to these civil rights through nonviolent action and strategies. He was a man of peace, a man who preferred to use his mind rather than his muscles. And this is so rare in our world.
Dalia works in Cairo for the American Islamic Congress. They asked her to translate the Montgomery comic book into Arabic. An Egyptian security officer tried to block publication, but after Dalia met with him and used lessons from Martin Luther King, she turned her enemy into an ally. He even asked for copies of the comic book for his kids. When the original was published in 1958, it also had to skirt censors. A Christian pacifist group hired one of the creators of the Little Abner comic strip to illustrate it, and a blacklisted comic book writer to write the text in a way that would fall inside the guidelines of American censorship rules in place at the time. The book was so controversial, many readers burned it to protect themselves. Others were inspired by it to launch the lunch counter sit-ins in Greensboro, North Carolina, soon after. The book spread to apartheid-era South Africa, where it was banned. It was translated into Spanish and distributed throughout Latin America. But as we said, about 50 years later, the comic book played a role in the Arab Spring. Dalia Ziada is hoping to spread King's influence further. She ran for parliament in the recent elections and is waiting the results. Back in a minute, here and now.
I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share.
If you're looking for a good food read, might we recommend Chef Gabriel Hamilton's memoir, Blood, Bones, and Butter, The Inadvertent Education of a Reluctant Chef. It's out in paperback this month. Chef Anthony Bourdain called it simply the best memoir by a chef ever. Gabrielle writes about growing up in rural Pennsylvania in a romantic, converted old silk mill, the daughter of a French ballerina who ruled the house with an oily wooden spoon, and a set designer father who, at the yearly spring lamb roast they threw for neighbors and fancy New York friends, would slowly baste lambs from a clean metal paint can filled with olive oil, crushed rosemary garlic, and chunks of lemon.
All day long, as we did our chores, the smell of gamey lamb, applewood smoke, and rosemary garlic marinade commingled and became etched into our brains. I have clung to it for 30 years, that smell. I have a chronic summertime yearning to build large fires outdoors and slowly roast whole animals. I could sit fireside and baste until sundown.
It seemed magical. Until it wasn't. When she was 13, Gabrielle's parents divorced spectacularly. As she writes, her menopausal, rage-filled mom decamped to Vermont, and Gabrielle was left to fend for herself. Gabrielle Hamilton's hit New York restaurant is called Prune. Again, her memoir, Bloods, Bones, and Butter. When we spoke last year, she told us more about her early memories of food with her elegant mom getting raw milk from a local farm.
My mother is rather extraordinary that she could get down and buy raw milk in our recycled plastic container while wearing a high heel and her, right. Her hair pulled back neatly. Mm-hmm. She taught me a lot that I use in the restaurant now in terms of she had a very distinct sense of thrift, rather fastidious cleaning impulses as well. And she knew how to get everything comestible from the shin or neck of some animal. I mean, she was feeding a family of seven on my father's rather mercurial artist paycheck. So I learned from her sort of the nitty-gritty of what I've come to use now running Prune. My dad has that massive sense of generosity. He's always giving, and he likes to have big parties, and he's very social, and he's thinking of the smell of wood smoke as the guests arrive. So that I get some of that, too. I like to throw a party, and I really like people. So,
well, you know, and that's probably what makes it harder. You know, when they split, Mom moves to Vermont. Dad stays but is sort of checked out. What she left behind, cans of sardines, stale Triscuits, you know, you're feeding yourself at 13.
I kind of learned to cook by opening jars and cans of strange things that my mother had left behind there in the pantry. And at the same time, I knew that I needed money. So I headed into town. I thought, well, I'm going to work in a restaurant. That's probably a good thing for me to do. And as soon as they led me into the kitchen, I felt comfortable right away, and I've, of course, spent 30 years in a kitchen since.
Well, and this began your long road working in kitchens, catering services, a summer camp, but it also began this life of, lying about your age, you know, experimenting with drugs, dropping in and out of school.
Well, as soon as I found myself on my own, I immediately began to cultivate a kind of chain-smoking, very obscene language kind of character, I think, as a defense.
Let's take you to New York. You get to New York. You're still underage, working waitress in a bar. You write there's a complicated system. I mean, who knew? But you describe for us this complicated system that waitresses used in bars.
Well, I was engaged in a scam there that I ended up getting busted for and charged with grand larceny and possession of stolen property.
Well,
and fortunately, I was underage, and so I slipped out of that one.
Then you moved to the catering business, which is huge in Manhattan. You've been exposed to some of the most amazing things that catering can yield, things like edible gold leaf floating in champagne flutes or pale green sugar glass blown into the shapes of apples. So what did you glean from the catering industry?
The wonderful thing about catering as opposed to restaurant work is that you will be handling such a variety of ingredients in the very same day, so that you are doing, let's say, a Moroccan dinner for one place and a modern hors d'oeuvres that something will be showing up at the Modern Art Museum later. You know, you are handling a wide variety of ingredients, and it's a tremendous exposure. Whereas when you work in a restaurant, let's say you work in a Northern Italian restaurant, you're not ever going to know what toasted couscous is, and you will not probably touch much cilantro or things like that. So yeah, that was the best part of catering. What I also ended up loving about it in the end is that it really taught me everything I did not want to do when I eventually opened my restaurant. I did not want to have food that was touched by possibly six people by the time it went into the tummy of the guest. guest.
Right. Or, you know, sat on a delivery truck for, oh, a day, you know, in that
That's right. It really informed me when I opened Prune that this would be a place where I could cook it in the pan, probably using nothing more than a wooden spoon, set it immediately onto the plate and onto your table. It would not be pre-cooked, par-cooked, broken down into several components and done on different days of the week, and I would pretty much be the only person touching that food.
Yeah. I want to touch on another chapter in your life, again, before you get to Prune. You realize you had this desire to write, and this also may be born from your mother who gave you your first journal, but you make your way to Ann Arbor. You're in a writing program there. That doesn't go that well, but you meet you meet a woman, and her way of cooking blows you away.
Yeah, when I was 30-something, I decided to go to the University of Michigan and get a degree just to see if I could be a writer. I had wanted to be a writer my whole life. And I arrived and needed to get a job immediately, so I got a job at a catering company. I met the chef there, Misty. She knew so much about every ingredient. She knew how to can it, pickle it, smoke it. Plus, she had grown it. And she was cooking in a way that triggered my past, which I had forgotten in a way. I'd been working in these industrial, horrible kitchens for so long that that became my cooking style, even though it was so not what I was born into. And Misty really conjured all that for me. And so I came back with my MFA and opened a restaurant.
Yeah. Well, there's other chapters, too. You traveled the world. You went to France, did the hostel scene. But you come across this really decrepit site, encrusted espresso machines, rat feces, dishes in the sink. This was an abandoned restaurant. But in your mind, you saw what?
It was electrifying. I could see in there this little 30-seat gem. The stove was very close to the dining room, obviously, because it's my restaurant is as big as nothing. Your closet, probably. And I knew that I could cook honestly, and the way that I wanted to eat in that space, it just caught me.
What is the appeal for you, given how much work it is?
I love this work. The insanities that are inherent in kitchen work happen to correspond to my own, so that works out well. It's like, I'm a little bit crazy, this industry's a little bit crazy, but I love that it's so tangible and tactile what you've done by the end of the day. At 5 o'clock, there is your food at the ready. It's also a place, a kitchen, where the whole human condition, if you will, exists. There's competition and jealousy and celebration and joy and loneliness. Everything is there, right there. Mm-hmm. So it's a place brimming with life, and that appeals to me so much, particularly as I've started to write, which is, I guess, as we all know who do it, very lonely and very isolated. And to have now the two things in my life is such a pleasure.
That's Gabrielle Hamilton, chef and owner of Prune Restaurant. By the way, Prune, your childhood nickname. the memoir is Blood, Bones, and Butter, The Inadvertent Education of a Reluctant Chef. Gabrielle, thanks so much.
I thank you.